welcome to the Motivational Interviewing and Beyond podcast. I'm Joel Porter, and on behalf of my co-hosts, Steve Rolnick and Kendall Bond, along with our producer, Angela Watkins, we certainly welcome you to this month's podcast. This month, we had Molly McGill join us to have a conversation with Steve about the upcoming Motivational Interviewing 4th Edition book. And I thought we had a quite wide range conversation. We covered a lot of territory, had some laughs, shared some ideas. There were some great questions and thoughts that emerged from the audience. And we just carried on for quite a while talking about motivational interviewing, where it's at, the thinking behind it. And I certainly hope you enjoy this podcast as much as we enjoyed making it. Next month, we're aiming to talk about motivational interviewing and artificial intelligence and trying to figure out what the future holds in regards to learning, coding, and practicing motivational interviewing. So take care, and we'll see you next month. Steve, with wine in hand, are you ready to go?
Yeah, whenever you are. Amazing right. Group of...
This is okay, incredible.
Yeah, people still coming in. We're up to about 174, so let's get going. So good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. Kia ora, welcome. It's great to see everybody here. I'm Joel Porter, and this is Motivational Interviewing Beyond with our wonderful guest, Molly McGill, and my co-hosts, Kendall and Steve. So I guess we're going to talk about the upcoming book with Steve. We've got a captive audience here, or captive speaker here, Steve. And we thought with the new edition of the Motivational Interviewing book coming up, that it would be a nice time to just have a conversation with Steve. And, you know, there's the three of us that have some ideas and questions, and then there's 197 other people that might have a few questions. So if we don't have Ange here today, so if Kendall, if you can help, or Molly, if you want to help monitor the chat and the questions, it'd be great to get as many people involved in this conversation as possible.
Absolutely fine. I'm happy to try and keep an eye on all the questions and ask them to everybody as well. As much as you want.
Okay. Well, Molly's been a guest here before. She's a favorite of the crew, and it's great to have you here. Do you have a question you'd like to start off with, Molly, or a thought to get us going?
Well, I'm very happy to be here. I'm super excited about where this conversation is going to potentially go. And it could be starting off with a hard one, but one of the thoughts I had in my head was really thinking about how the new version of the MI book is like, does or does not, or fits in with how our culture is changing. And at least like in academia, I see like a lot of rapid change. And I think all around us, we see a lot of rapid change. And I wonder how much of that is in the book.
What sort of
starting off with just as wild as you could and woolly as you can get.
Yeah, that's wonderfully broad and interesting. And what sort of changes are you talking about, Molly?
When I think about like people becoming much more attuned to language and having like a critical lens on the language that we use in everyday conversations and paying more attention to it, I think about the heightened attention to social justice and to empowerment and to just compassionate living. And so all of those things remind me of motivational interviewing, and it feels like these things have always been like MI has always been happening kind of in tandem with cultural changes that seem compatible, but that could be like just the lens through which I'm viewing the situation. But yeah, that's my question, my first question, and the broadest.
Right out of the gate.
Yeah, brought up and you're wondering to what extent this book might embrace some of the breadth of change that you've noticed.
Maybe touch upon it, like from a content, you know, content level, like how much it touches upon where MI fits in society or changes in society, you know, among some of us. It's not among all of us. We're all not in a unified sort of direction, but.
Incredible. So if there was a topic that could capture the essence of what you're wondering about, what might that topic be?
How does MI4 fit in with changes we see in our culture around social justice, compassion, attention to language? Those are like a few examples.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, I can see that. And they're not easily unified by a single phrase. And I suspect that, first of all, I can't answer it.
Okay.
Off the top of my head, but we could maybe find an answer by the end of the webinar, I hope.
That's a broad question that different people in different places around the world would be looking at a little, have different ideas about, you know. But that could be a whole conversation for another webinar. But I understand what you're saying, Molly. These are changing times, particularly in the Anglo world. I'll be interested to see. I got some ideas just from what I know about MI4, but I'll be interested to see how we get going with that. So hold that in mind, everybody, and as the conversation goes. I'm going to back it up to a more broader question, Steve. Mm-hmm. Why MI4? Why a fourth edition of the motivational interviewing book?
It's a good question, Joel. Bill carries on. He doesn't turn corners, eh? He's carrying on. He must be a good, maybe 10 years older than me. I've turned 70 and feel like I've turned a corner, right? But Bill carries on in a straight line. So for him, every 10 years or so, we seriously consider this. And then the question arose, well, why would we want to write a new edition? And there unfolded a series of conversations between us. And out of those conversations came this fourth edition. Okay. So again, I don't have a simple answer to your question. I think by the end of the webinar, you should be able to feel reasonably comfortable about that, Joel. But if you don't, it'll be wonderful to hear how you do feel.
Rosa okay. Thomas in the chat mentioned the idea of starting with the definition of motivational interviewing through editions that evolved. The definition has evolved. Has it evolved in the fourth edition?
I think it's the most important element of this fourth edition that I still find profound and can't quite grasp the implications of. So I think it's a great starting point.
Okay. So what is the new definition?
A way of talking with people about change and growth in order to strengthen their motivation and commitment. A way of talking to people about change and growth.
And growth is a broadening.
As is the word change, because in the earlier definitions, they were focused on the goal of MI being to address behavior change. And then I remember exactly when it was. It was 2009, in response to observations, critiques, and suggestions from close friends and colleagues in the MI community, we talked about removing the word behavior from the definition. That was in 2009. And I felt strongly at the time that that was a profound thing to suggest and agreed with it. And indeed, there's a couple of people here in the webinar today that were involved in those discussions and were very strongly influential. So, like, I wanted to say that, you know, before we dive into the implications of that change in definition, this is not just sort of Bill and Steve writing this definitive edition. It's there are many friends and colleagues over 30 to 40 years whose views are expressed in this. And I suppose also it's not the last word on the subject. It's not the only way of describing motivational interviewing, and it's certainly not the last word in it. If it was the last word, then the field would stagnate. So the fact that there are a host of unanswered questions, I think, is a good thing. And sincerely hope that others take the field in different directions as they see appropriate. But I suppose what we felt responsible for was creating some kind of broad and constructive framework that gives people the freedom to explore why, where, and how MI might be used. So I just wanted to say that from the off. It's not just the Bill and Steve fourth edition. This is just a guiding framework.
So we have a couple of questions around it, Steve, if I can ask you.
Yeah.
That what people are putting out there. So Judith Carpenter was talking about, she's curious where ambivalence fits in with the new definition, or do you feel that it's just implicit with this broader?
I don't think we've adequately resolved it. I think, I must confess that Bill and I don't always see eye to eye. We love and adore each other as friends and human beings and colleagues, but we don't altogether see eye to eye. And what felt like very central all the way through the decades, this concept of ambivalence, about which I have some concerns anyway, okay, which is a separate discussion, probably not for tonight. The moment you say it's about growth and development, then you're moving away from the classic position of ambivalence, which was nicely centered when we were talking about behavior change, because it was particularly addiction behavior change, because ambivalence was so common. Once you remove the word behavior from change, there are plenty of scenarios where people face change where they don't necessarily feel ambivalent, right? And so I ask you to consider the quality of exchange between Bill and I and the sort of looks that I got during lockdown, actually, which was a very special time for forming warm and helpful relationships. And that happened to Bill and I, but I made this point. And so I'm not entirely sure we've dealt with it adequately, but yes, I feel that ambivalence is sometimes a very heightened and serious issue for people, and sometimes not. And this book nevertheless treads that rather traditional line, which I object to. I think some of the elements and the focus on ambivalence, they haven't really caught up with the potential ramifications of a broader definition, which has it that it's about change and growth. For me personally, I had some experiences at home that shifted my grasp of this. I'm happy to talk about them or not. Just telling you, it comes from quite deep down for me.
If you're happy to share, I think that would be really fascinating. Joel, I think you had a question as well.
Go ahead, Steve. It's real present for you right now.
Yeah. Well, and it's quite a few years, probably 5-6 years ago. But and Dave Rosengren will be he's on this webinar tonight, and he'll be well familiar with the exchanges with me about whether you can use MI at home, because in a way that is in the outer reaches of the application of MI. Actually, Molly's made it even wider. And that's why I couldn't answer it, Molly. You know, can it be used in the service of much wider political and social activities? I mean, that's, you know, but for me, using MI at home was always something I puzzled about. And when we had the definition around behavior change, it felt a bit like, oh, well, his room's untidy. Therefore, you use MI to effect behavior change. And the obvious problem there, which David Rosengreen and I exchanged over the years, and Bill, is that it's my problem. I'm emotionally invested in that room being tidy, you know. So there's a problem there with not only my heightened sense of my lack of emotional regulation to begin with, but the fact that it's more my problem than his. Okay, so that in that sense it drew a blank, and then I asked David. I had an experience which I'll tell you about, but I asked David Rosengreen about his experience with parent effectiveness training. Okay, which comes from Thomas Gordon. Only for David to tell me that he grew up in a household of pet parents, parent effectiveness training. They were parent effectiveness trained, and he grew up in it. So I bought the book, which I think was called Parent Effectiveness Training. And in that book, I noticed that MI is just a very minor extension of what's in that book. And so for me, I settled into quite a comfortable perspective, which is that MI could be extremely useful at home if it is in the service of the growth and development of the child, not the clean room. Okay. And I was thinking this sort of thing when my daughter came home weeping, saying that she was having lunch in the toilet at school because every time she went out, there were anti-Semitic messages and videos and cartoons being shown to her. And she was extremely distressed. And I managed to sit on my hands and restrain myself from going up to the school and giving them hell and pulling my daughter out of the school, which was what the writing reflex was telling me to do. I managed to stop my oldest son, who's a police officer, who said that those kids are breaking the law. I'm going in there. Right. So we stopped all that activity. And we asked her what she thought the best way forward was, and we would support her. And then it got reframed along the lines of you feeling very victimized, but how could you turn this around so that you stand up for yourself? And it was a transformative experience for her, absolutely transformative. Now, that experience persuaded me that all the skills of MI could be used in the service of promoting growth and change in this young person, as long as I remain emotionally regulated, sitting on my hands and resisting the writing reflex. So it was those sort of forces that joined and allowed me to sort of express this to Bill. And that's where that definition comes from. So it's the goal of MI is much broader. And I'm left with the feeling that we've only touched the surface here, because if we take this one for a walk, if we also consider that MI is used naturally in so many circumstances by people who know nothing about it, and as our friends on this webinar, Dave Rosengreen and Chris Wagner, will point out, are they using it intentionally? Are they intentionally reflecting change talk? That's an interesting question. But I felt and feel that there's a sufficient groundswell of natural use of many of the elements of MI to cater for this broader definition. I wonder if I'm being clear.
Yeah. To me,
Yeah.
Being a control freak from way back, I'm immediately wondering about structure and operationalization. And so you have like I'm thinking about two potential paths, the behavior change path, the broad change and growth path, and will they be sufficiently operationalized to still hold on to all those wonderful bits of structure that MI has contributed to the field? And I think part of this comment does come from the chat, and I forget the person that brought it up, but they brought up the targeted behavior change and coding and, you know, the implications of quote unquote change, quote unquote growth broadly for things like, you know, coding and fidelity monitoring and things like that.
That was from Fiona. And
thank you.
Yeah, what she said was, so if the shift has been moved away from the term behavior in coding MI, selecting a target behavior is critical to using the MITEI. And just, you know, for those of you that maybe don't know, MITEI is one of the coding tools for motivational interviewing. And does this change open up MI to new arenas? And so does it impact coding practices at all? And then Fiona goes on to say that was really helpful. And actually in education, the conversation, she feels that this shift will be really helpful within the broader fields, which I think is fascinating.
I think Bill did a, Miller did a, did like a little webinar 2-3 weeks ago about the changes in MI4. And when he put the definition up on his slide, and it was, I think what Bill said, it's a particular way of talking with people about change and growth in order to strengthen motivation and commitment. And for my first thought, well, he could be talking about many different kinds of therapies. Mm. So what separates motivational interviewing from something like solution-focused therapy, something like ACT, because those are about change and growth, maybe not necessarily motivation, well, ACT's about commitment. But then I thought the doorway into that for me was a particular kind of conversation, which will later be defined as you get into motivational interviewing. Now, the interesting thing about me and what I'm looking forward to hear is how you describe the process, not the four processes or tasks of motivational interviewing, but how does it look, right? And that's a coding question, I suppose, as well, too. So if you don't have a change goal, forget about behavior change, a change goal, what's a growth goal, right? I mean, so I think part of it is gonna be an unfolding process as people start to operationalize these things and try to better understand them and to say, well, you know, how do we look at this? What was the original definition of MI? Was it a directive and client-centered approach for initiating change through exploring and resolving ambivalence? From that, as well it should be, you know, good things grow in time. So it's a big shift from the way, you know, a lot of us learned and have practiced and coded and taught MI for decades. Are moving towards.
It feels very much.
I hope we don't lose some of the tangible parts of it along the way, where it becomes anything. Like you know, you can spread it on anything and it'll taste good. But that might be a good thing too.
I'm just really fascinated how we're all responding to this change. In itself, like quite a meta thing. So I can see as well in the chat, there's a lot of people saying, but I'm a trainer and, you know, or I'm a clinician and how's this change going to affect us? And there's that real anxiety about how does it fit? We're letting go of maybe what we knew. and how we're bringing in that to now. And I think Jamie and Michelle are just talking about it feels more organic and encompassing the spirit of MI. And I like that. I think that that works from my side, but I can hear this sense of, but also how does it work when we're trying to train it, especially with things around two-day training and the guidance of how we train. So Steve, I don't know if you'll be willing to talk to that and the operational element that Molly was talking about as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of hesitating to pull out the writing reflex here, but, you know, since you asked a straight question, Molly, you deserve, and this question is not broad in general or vague, like, you know, it's, this question's quite specific. Maybe the instruments are got to be adapted. You know, and that that adaptation process, even if it doesn't happen, those instruments are still extremely useful. Behavior change is often the goal in a conversation. And there might be a need to broaden them, but it doesn't stop us, not me, sorry, I shouldn't say us. It doesn't stop people developing them. But yeah.
It's interesting. We could carry this conversation on the whole time about the the definition, the implications, and the understanding. How about we look at, like, you know, what's in the box, right? So when people who've read MI3 pick up the book MI4, what are some of the things they're going to see that are maybe different, or that okay. You guys have re-looked at, retooled a bit, or as Molly said one day, repurposed.
Yeah, not a huge amount, I feel. We set out to make MI more accessible and to use less jargon. Because with this wider definition, we anticipated a much wider range of helpers using MI. So, and I was looking at the book through the lens of what is helpfulness. It was that broad for me. And Bill was served a very useful function of going, whoa, 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 you know, this is MI. So we set out to make the book simpler and more accessible, given this wider definition. And in order to deal with the concerns of those with a more professional therapeutic orientation, we've got these like therapist boxes running right through the book that drop a little bit deeper into issues that we know of interest to therapists. So that's like a design and presentation matter, which felt very important and potentially useful. We replaced the word processes with tasks. So that's quite simple. Okay. Just couldn't see the value in calling them something more complicated. They're tasks you carry out with people. We then hit a problem, which was that in the third edition, the word evoking was used in both the spirit and as one of the processes. And I felt this was a confusing error. So then we had a lot of discussion, okay, because we decided that obviously that evoking as a process is very powerful, or a task is a very powerful feature of MI that renders it perhaps a little different to client-centered counseling or what Thomas Gordon was describing in parent effectiveness training. So we keep evoking as one of the key tasks, as one of the four tasks. The question then is, what's an alternative word for evoking that sort of captures the same quality? And we couldn't find one, actually. And in the end, Bill felt that the word empowerment was the closest we'll get to. Okay. And now empowerment can be interpreted in different ways, but we are quite careful to describe it in a way that's compatible with MI. Okay. So in the spirit, that's the one change from the third to the fourth edition. That we have acceptance, collaboration, compassion, and empowerment. Works for me, but then I don't I work in settings that are quite diverse, like on the side of a sports field. And I think what unites parents, coaches, teachers, therapists, and everybody is the joy of witnessing people feeling empowered and changing and growing, whatever the field. So that's a definite change. Not a huge amount else, actually. It's possible I've missed out some things, but I don't think so. You know, there's chapters on the remote delivery of MI, as you can imagine, written during lockdown. It's a chapter on ethical considerations. And then someone asked a question about simple versus complex affirmations. Bill and I could never agree about that. I mean, the disagreements were such fun and so serious that we just decided not to address the issue that I wanted us to address, which was the widespread dysfunctional and sometimes toxic use of praise in parenting and education. And he's got a much more sympathetic attitude towards praise than me. So, you know, so I got caught in a little bit of a dichotomy there between praise bad, affirmation good, and, you know, tried to create a continuum and all sorts of things. And Bill just said, look, no, don't agree. So we left it out. And then I believe it was Terry Moyes who came up with this distinction between simple and complex affirmations. I'm not planning to kind of go into the kind of minutiae of that distinction. I think you'll see the book's coming out soon, eh? Book's coming out soon in a few months' time. So that kind of lets me off the hook for having to remember every detail. But I think there's a very powerful perspective that MI lends finesse to. It's not a perspective that's unique to MI, but it MI lends finesse to a view of people as having strengths and not just things wrong with them. And if that perspective is there in your heart and head, affirmations will come naturally to you. I do notice here, hang on, in the comments, Dave Rosengren says, I think envisioning is better. That's an interesting
envisioning
one.
Envisioning is part of the spirit.
Yeah, that's what Dave is suggesting.
Well, Dave, you can't just throw that out and then leave Steve to wrestle with it. How about you join us for a few minutes and share your thoughts a little bit? Y'all keep going. It'll take me a second to find you.
Be a good idea. Peter Reeves is asking, Steve said collaboration. Are we back to collaboration or still with partnership? Peter, you got to forgive me. Okay, I might have made an error there. Okay. Simple answer is I don't know. I'll have a look. Okay, Peter. While David's talking now, I'll have a look. I feel like there's our man.
You have a way, Dave, of having disruptive thoughts and questions. So envisioning.
Well, that's my usual role. Well, so I know I had said this to Steve before. I just think that the idea of empowerment, while it makes perfect sense and people love that term, it does imply that we are providing the power to someone else. And that's what that definition implies. If we look at the primary one versus the secondary one, which is more helping the person recognize it within themselves. And it seems to me that something along the lines of envisioning is just much more accurate. We're assisting them and seeing it within themselves and claiming it. It's already there. We're not providing it to them. So that's my thought there. I just think it's a strategic mistake that kind of keeps us in some of the things that Molly was referencing in her original question about social justice and equity and those kinds of things. When we bestow the power on the other, then we remain the sort of the power broker in that circumstance, rather than taking the other position, which is the power resides in you and we're just helping you see it. That's my thought.
That's a good thought. Steve, you have some reflection on that, or you want to?
Very good point, Dave. Very good point.
Can I ask a question about that? So what I like about the envisioning is it really links with change talk as well. And when we look at the research around the change talk and the future tenses being a big part of outcomes, the idea of envisioning really supports quite a lot of other therapeutic modalities as well, which links with future planning, future thinking, and connecting with the future self. So, David, in your thinking, when we're looking at that as opposed to empowerment, and obviously not to dismiss empowerment right now, how would you intend to use that, or how would you like to bring that in yourself when you're delivering MI training or practice?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think people are already doing it. That's sort of the interesting thing, is I don't think it requires an entirely different way of doing what we're doing already. We hear quotes from folks like Stephen Andrew has this lovely quote of not meeting people where they are, but where they dream, because where they are currently is often pretty difficult. And he works in the drug and alcohol field. So that's an example of someone helping to envision. I think in terms of the definition of it, it's really getting people to think not just what you're seeing now, but what are their hopes or aspirations, what are their values, what is the ideal self that they're hoping to lean into along the way, and really taking that future focused look, even as we're sort of listening to what's going on with them at the moment, at the present. So I think you're spot on. That's a future oriented kind of way of thinking about all of this. It's not staying stuck in the status quo, but it's offering for the individual an opportunity to see themselves in a different way, in a new light.
And for me, what I like about that is how that actually links with empowerment. Mm-hmm. That as a clinician, we're looking to empower our clients in order to feel able to actualize their future self, mm-hmm. or to connect with their future self. And I guess that sometimes that ambivalence or that dissociation or disconnect from who we are now and who we are in the future, part of MI is building that intrinsic connection with who I am right now is also who I intend to be in the future, or who I am in the future.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Kendall. I think and this is where I get into sort of semantics around that. I don't think it's empowering them. I think the power is already there. They just feel the power in a way that they haven't experienced it before. And I just want to firmly keep this sense that that doesn't reside within me. It resides within you. And through the work that we're doing together, I'm just holding that up for you to see. I can see it, but I know you don't quite see it yet.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's really beautiful. And there's a lot of things coming in the chat, so I'll just step back and read the chat. And Steve, I don't know if anyone else wants to comment.
And feel free to take me off, Steve. I didn't want to derail discussion of MI4. It's just one of those things that I feel strongly about.
You're doing exactly what we were hoping we wanted to do, with have a nice, broad conversation. Okay. I don't want to kick you out. So can you take yourself out? Because I kicked a couple people out in the last webinar when I de-promoted them. I don't know how to do it. Angie didn't hear. So if you could, I'll play around.
Feel free to kick me out, Joel. I'll just join again.
Okay. I don't want to do that though.
I just want to, Anne, now, excuse me, Anne, I might be saying your name wrong. So Witte-Wrongel is asking in French, is it envisioning? And that she's not sure of this word. And I just want to say that I think other people might have answered this, that it's envisageur. So I don't know how that works for those people that are better at French than I am. I should be better. Can somebody help Anne just clarify what this word means in French as well? Would that be right? Okay, you get it, Anne? Okay, that's good. I should know. I'm Belgian, so I should really know, shouldn't I? But I'm not very good at it anymore. Okay, right, Steve, sorry, take away.
No, I was just wondering, I heard David say, I feel very strongly about this, and I'm puzzled about what he feels strongly about. We have Chris Wagner saying he's comfortable with empowerment. And he also likes envisioning, which is how I feel, exactly how I feel as well. And David feels strongly about this. And I wonder if there's any substantial difference if we constructed a piece of dialogue or even had a dialogue with somebody, whether there'd be any difference between how we view a constructive helping conversation informed by MI. I'm not convinced. And, you know, frankly, you can see I'm not particularly anxious about this, because if you're a trainer, share this distinction with people. I don't think it's a big issue, but maybe this is a bit kind of misplaced informality on my part, and maybe I'm not appreciating how the impact of what a book like this might be. Maybe, but
well, Steve Michael over in Australia, one MI trainer said that he recently has done a couple trainings after listening to Bill's talk about the 3 to 4, and in the Mint Oceania had a mini forum, and they talked about this. And Michael said that the more accessible language and a broadening of MI as a way of operationally all helping relationships as a way of doing everything else seemed to land with the audience in a much more profound way than I'd experienced. So it seemed like, you know, talking about MI with the less jargony way and the more conversational way connected for his audience. I think I got that right, Michael. Certainly you'll correct me if I'm wrong. But I think there's something to that. I think it is a more engaging language that you and Bill have pushed forward in terms of trying to explain motivational interviewing. If that makes sense.
Yeah, and I see Jamie saying he loves the word evoke, and uses a slide with a seed sprouting into a plant. Well, and Jamie, me too. And that's the core evoking process or task that is at the heart of MI. In other words, if you adopt that spirit, and by the way, I made a mistake. I'll come back to it. There was a word in the spirit which is as it was in MI3, okay? I'll come back to it. But if you adopt that spirit, then that beautiful seed sprouting metaphor becomes relevant as the conversation unfolds. And that evoking task is essentially about watering that flower, that seed. I think there was a problem that Bill and I couldn't resolve, which was that, do you notice how MI was originally focused on ambivalence about change, sort of aligned with the stages of change model in the 1980s and 1990s. It gave rise to this, I felt, spurious and inappropriate characterization of MI is for when people are in contemplation, then when they're in action, then you do something else. And I've always felt this was inappropriate, spurious, and oversimplified, simply because when you talk about plans with people, you notice that same ambivalence. And if ever there's a scenario where the writing reflex can be dysfunctional. It's when you're planning with people, because you're just dying to tell people what to do. So in the planning task, evoking is what you do. So why have we got evoking and then planning? And I don't think we resolved that. Okay, so there's an area for future development. We tried in the discussion lots of different ways of doing it, like abandoning the distinction between evoking and planning and just calling it evoking. And sometimes you're evoking why someone might consider a change. And you might also consider evoke how they might achieve that change. And I got pretty close to winning on that. We use that why-how distinction quite a lot as a way of simplifying the language. And I got close to agreement about abandoning that distinction, but not all the way there.
Molly, I don't know if you want to add to that at all.
I think Steve would agree that they're not supposed to be full distinctions anyway, right? Isn't it like a Venn diagram?
Yep. It is. But there's a problem with calling evoking one task and then planning another task as if they're distinct, when the verb evoking describes an activity of watering that seed that might be in the planning process as well. And we deal with that. We get around it by reminding the reader of that, but it felt like a conceptual problem that we didn't resolve. And okay.
But the continued parallel process is being, you know, very increasingly sort of mindful about language and the implications of language, the term empowerment or envisioning, and what are the implications of it. And it's, I mean, it's really what we make of it and how we define it to a certain extent. I mean, we obviously have to do our homework and look at the origins of particular words and trace their roots and figure out which is the best one to use. But it seems like as MI has evolved over time, that has been a big part of the process.
Yeah, I'm surprised it took us so many years from 2009, to be honest with you, Molly. I'm quite surprised how long it took us from 2009 to fully absorb the implications of dropping the word behavior from the definition. I'm quite surprised about that. But there you go. Change it.
Well, I wonder if the process here, or part of the process here, is beginning, and maybe I'm just fixated on operationalization, which I totally am, but, you know, is operationalizing that other side of motivational interviewing, that you know, that the change and growth side, right? The behavior change side is nailed down pretty well, right? I'm not saying it has arrived, but, you know, there's a lot of great tools and infrastructure there, as opposed to this other piece when people are saying, well, you know, there is no behavior change on the table. I'm still using MI. It's a lens through which I see treatment. It's a lens through which I see humanity, you know, and what does that look like? And do you need to create a level of precision there so that you can train it and replicate it and discriminate it? Do you need to discriminate it or not? I mean, we seem to be discriminating the two.
What's your gut feeling here, Molly?
About what?
About this issue of, for example, measurement, given this wider definition.
My biases are so biased that they're, you know, that I'm going to want structure and precision and key terms. And so, yeah, it's exactly what I said, that this idea of, you know, a lens through which to see treatment and humanity, right? Because it really is both. You can't, if you're being genuine, you can't separate the two. You can't separate how you are in treatment from how you see humanity. So, and people for years and years and forever, as long as MI has been evolving, people have been holding on to so many pieces of the spirit that, you know, that this is a force in motion. And so, yeah, my gut is just that, yeah, that some of that structure and operationalization might be a force in motion and a very big, or some part of what's happening in MI4, since I have no clue what's happening in MI4. Or maybe it's MI5. And then, no, yeah. Maybe. No. Yeah.
It'll be a work in progress again, Molly. I think researchers like yourself and Terry and other people who are really in the weeds in trying to understand not only, you know, how MI works, but what exactly is happening here. And maybe with a broader definition, there's more space to explore, because you're not as grounded as to behavior or specific things. So you might look at change and grow and try to expand that a little bit more. Maybe a growth conversation is going to sound a little bit different than a specific change conversation. That, you know, I want to quit smoking. You know, that's a change thing. I want things to be better in my life. I want to be a better parent, you know, those sorts of things. That would be kind of a growth conversation in my mind.
But the techniques of MI are such that both are outputs. So the envisioning and the empowerment and the seeing oneself differently is an output of a behavior change conversation, just by virtue of what you reflect and how you sit with a person. But MI is such a big part, at least for me personally, of like teaching me how to sit with a person, of how to see those things.
Well, if you think about it, I mean, I'm the psychotherapist, and the end of the day, you know, however you get there, a primary goal is the behavior change. Right? Insight's great, but if I don't put it into action and do something different, then what's changed, other than I'm aware of this thing that's happening in my life, but it's still happening and I'm not satisfied or happy with the way things are going. Making a decision could result in a behavior change or something different happening in my life. So I'm with you on that. And right. That's it. I just wonder if the process or the conversation might be different. I remember when we kind of moved in MI towards like broadening, you know, MI is more than maybe just a behavior change, but making a choice or to do something, move in a different direction. And that was a little bit kind of confusing as well, too.
Yeah. I tell you, just to raise something perhaps a bit left of center, but see what you think about this. I work in sport mostly at the moment, and I've noticed, and I've had the experience in other places, the more expert people are, the less they listen. Okay. The less they see it as relevant or important to listen. And in sharp contrast, I was very struck by the work of a colleague here in Cardiff, Wales, in the United Kingdom, who taught MI to these 16-year-old school students in a peer support program. And I watched these kids demonstrate it live on a stage in front of hundreds of people. They had it nailed. They had it nailed because they didn't see themselves as experts. They saw their task as to have a helpful conversation in which they guide someone to search for a way to feel happier, if you like. So there's a bit of a paradox there that pulls me with optimism with this wider definition, because MI is something that could be used by people who are perhaps a little less expert, who are bound to be a little bit more curious and better able to listen. But that does leave us with a problem in trying to, we hit another paradox if we try to consider how you can, and it's an issue we haven't discussed tonight, beyond the world of the conversation or the consultation or the therapeutic session, can MI be used more widely in an organization to improve relationships and well-being among the people, the managers and the colleagues and things? And of course, there we hit another paradox, which is, in a way, the more toxic an organization, the less likely are they going to be to want to learn anything like MI. And I find that paradox really difficult in my everyday life because I work in sporting organizations. Those that have got a good culture are dead interested in MI, but they're unfortunately in a minority. So there's a problem there. Now, I haven't really thought through what the implication of this wider definition is for organizational change, for improving the culture of an organization.
Lynn Johnson asked an interesting question that I think weaves into something like that. When you're bringing motivational interviewing into organization and managers with people who certainly don't see themselves as healthcare professionals or counselors or that. And so what would that look like? And so Lynn asked an interesting question, which was, is there still so much attention to darn cat change talk, given the evidence the original classification is based on?
Great question. Yes, there's just as much, and I couldn't dissuade Bill. Simple answer.
Okay.
He's on a kind of a straighter path than me, right? And you know, Joel, I wonder if I could bring our attention to Yonai Tillman's comment. I'm quite intrigued by it. A group I worked with over the years said their turnover stopped. Now, there's a linguistic thing here, Tonai, because turnover in the kind of Western English language means profit or whatever. And I'm not sure this is what you're talking about. But Joel, I'll leave it to you. Maybe we can get Yonai to come on and explain this. It's an interesting observation.
Loss of staff. So staff turnover.
Ah, so he's saying they held on to staff better.
Mm. Ah. Climate change. And not as in the climate change, but, you know, institutional climate change.
Yeah. Yep. And at some point, we might like to take this conversation to what are the new directions we should be looking at so that we can return to your opening question, Molly.
Okay.
And that links maybe with Fiona's point again, as she's interested to know, Steve, how you feel about taking MI into broader fields like schools and HE, and having MI-inspired conversations are surely helpful.
I have no hesitation about that. I think, as some of you might know, I collaborated with a group of friends in the MI field and wrote a book on MI for school teachers. Mm. And I work in sport, and every day, I observe the phenomenal impact of people feeling cared for through constructive conversation. It's phenomenal. They're starved of it. So you notice the exceptions when it happens, and it's remarkable. The impact on performance when people do feel someone's got their back. In education, I think it's an absolute, you know. And then you hit that paradox, which is that the more busy and stressed an organization is, like a school, the harder it is to introduce MI. And this I find painful, to be honest. I have no doubt about the potential, because if you ask a school teacher why they became a school teacher, you'll get the same answer as you do with a sports coach or a parent.
For those people that might not know as well, there are groups that work around MI in education. that you can access, and also the motivational interviewing in leadership and organizations, that it's definitely worth looking into as well. There's a lot of research and work that's being done around how motivational interviewing supports organizational change, cultural change. And also, I think for me, links with a lot of other research that really fits with MI around how empathy influences organizational change. And when Terry Moyers talks about, you know, the understanding that we have that often it's not the modality that's used, it's the therapeutic alliance. That's the thing that can make a difference. And from an organizational perspective, the research is also very strong on the fact that it's about the relationships and it's about those conversations that are being had. That's what makes the difference to people's self-awareness and self-engagement and engagement in organizations. So yeah, just for those that might not know that the Milo is out there, here's the link. And there's also MI in education as well, I think, isn't there?
There is one somewhere. Thank you so much, Kendall.
I haven't kind of taken a dive into MI and organization, so excuse my ignorance in this question. But I've been wondering the last little while, is, you know, as MI is broadening out, sometimes I wonder if people get the spirit of MI confused with what MI is. Like, you know, in terms of having better relationships with coworkers or people in the community, or things like that. Maybe what we're trying to do is have create better, to use your words, Kendall, therapeutic alliances or relational alliances with the people around us, but not so much worrying about the change talk kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. We just want to have understanding, compassionate, accepting conversations to kind of better understand someone's point of view. And what and what's important to them. And people will call that MI, but if you put it through one of the coding, you know, sessions, it would probably code out as a warm, empathic conversation that's low in change, cultivating change talk, and low in softening sustain talk.
So just to thinking about that, so I guess for me, if you look at the global scoring of my, and again, I know that some of us, we're using the Mighty Coding as a tool, and it's only one tool of motivational interviewing. But if we're looking at it from that sense, then the global, if you do the global side of it well, so the spirit of MI, surely as part of that, the evocation, if the evocation is truly there, so it's those four elements, and I know we're changing evocation to empowerment as well. But bringing that in, that's the bit that I often see is missing. And when somebody is stepping into that evocative space, that's when the change talk starts to occur, because I'm really curious about evoking your intrinsic motivation to change or your intrinsic desire to grow. And for me, that's when that automatically starts to kick in if we're skillful about it. So my understanding is where it's actually, there's elements of the spirit, so the empathy, the collaboration. But what's often missing is the genuine desire to help somebody grow and connect with their internal self that is wanting to change. I don't know if that makes sense.
It does. So are you agreeing with Joel?
Yes. And also no. yes, I am agreeing with Joel, but also recognizing that the behavioral stuff, I think when somebody is truly within the spirit, the behavioral stuff starts to occur with some refining, obviously, in coaching. What do you think,
Joel? Conversation between us. You agree and disagree with me at the same time.
Yes. Yeah, that's kind of standard, isn't it, for me?
Hey, Molly, do you want to take a look at, there's a question.
Yeah, Lynn's saying, how much variance does cultivating change talk and softening sustain talk actually account for? Was that the question you were talking about, Joel?
Yes, exactly.
I just Molly question, that is. That's a great Molly question.
My sense of where the question is coming from is that the relative amount of variance that technical aspect accounts for is probably small in comparison to the amount of variance that potentially the relationship accounts for. That's my guess, but small and variable. And I could get into lots of technical details as to why that is the case, just from a measurement standpoint. I mean, I feel like change talk is a tough road as far as getting that variable to fulfill its promise. It's such a beautiful construct, and then as a predictor, it's tough. So yeah, I would say that it's a pretty small effect size, and the research on showing the predictive elements of empathy has been kind of in MI has been I'm not coming up with the right word, but it has barriers due to the measure and the Likert scale for the empathy measure, and the fact that the majority of the research occurred, this is my, I don't know, opinion, probably shared by some, disagreed by others, but is occurring in the context of clinical trials where you have restricted range. And so, a lot of the research around the variance explained, say, by the therapist's empathy is more coming from the general psychotherapy literature than from the MI literature.
Wow.
But I'm still kind of holding out of this belief that it would be stronger than that change talk, sustain talk element. So there's a blend of opinion and science.
So on the heels of that question, I have a question that for you and Steve and anybody else in the audience that might have some thoughts about that. So there's been MI1, 2, 3, and we're on the eve of MI4 coming out. Is there any evidence to point towards or to indicate that MI2 is more effective than MI1 or MI3 is more effective than MI1 and 2? Has changing the language and changing some of the thinking around change and motivational interviewing, has that actually affected outcome when it's kind of been practiced in a very similar way? I know that change talk was a huge, jump in MI world. But is MI still fundamentally the same thing? We're just thinking about it in different ways.
You're asking two questions there. One is about what are the distinct differences between these two different editions? And I really, I mean, it's not, the editions aren't an intervention. So your question's difficult for me. You can't look at the effectiveness of a book, but your underlying point is, has it been worthwhile to develop MI in this way? And has that had any impact? I think it's, I wonder what other people think.
I think it's been worthwhile, but is there data to support that it's had a positive impact in terms of outcomes?
No, yeah. I mean, the only way of telling that, Molly, do correct me if I've got this wrong. If you find that MI is incredibly helpful in the home in helping children grow, would that answer your question adequately? In other words, with the widening applications of MI in increasingly wider circumstances, if there's evidence that a teacher does a better job having been trained in MI, wouldn't that answer your question? I don't know, Molly.
Well, I've got like a maybe two two answers. One is just from the standpoint of randomizing, you know, therapists trained under MI2 protocol versus MI4 protocol. You can barely get cognitive behavioral therapy to perform differently than motivational enhancement therapy. So if you have two subtly different versions of MI, chances are you're not going to find a difference. And if you do, it's going to be for certain people on certain outcomes and so on. So there's, you know, one thing to just say, it's a hard question to answer. And then the other thing, which is more to Steve's point, and probably a digression, but I notice that it is so much easier to teach MI to graduate social work students than it was 10 years ago. And I do not think that I'm better at teaching it. I think that the students are changing. And that gets back to my first question, which is around this idea of like, how does MI fit with forces that are already in motion and us as human and how we change as humanity? And I recognize that I have a particular lens through which I'm seeing those changes, but my students pick up MI really quickly now. And it's similar to what you said, Steve, about teaching children. And it's like, yeah, because the children are different somehow. And these concepts are resonating with them. And maybe that has nothing to do with Joel's question, but there you have it.
I don't think it's a straightforward question, to be honest. But I agree with you too. I think, you know, people are less, so I've been training MI for about 20 years now. And I certainly have less and less sort of people in the audience doing the yeah buts. Well, yeah, but this, particularly when the alcohol and drug world, when you start talking about spirit and evocation and working in partnership, you know, and doing reflective listening. And, you know, that used to be very contentious, particularly in the States when I would talk about motivational interviewing. A lot of pushback there. Now people just kind of take it in. Even in probation, I'm doing work in Australia with probation officers, and you know, they're very receptive to a non-confrontational and a more collaborative approach in working with people.
It's similar to the way MI was kind of compatible with the stages of change and how those shifts were occurring, where just the simple concept of motivation not being, you know, a static state that is action and actually, you know, being a continuum, and how, you know, MI was compatible with that. I think there are similar things happening now. So it does link to the question of like, is evolving it and having a fourth edition worth it? And it, because it's moving with other, you know, it's cross-fertilization with changes just in our world. And yeah. I'll stop there.
Yeah, and you know, it's been a bit of a puzzle to me, just in one particular context in which I've been privileged to work, which is in Southern Africa, in circumstances where people are really up against it. The patients and clients are really up against it in a system that is not well developed, and where practitioners are disempowered and burnt out and browned off. And yet it seems to strike a chord with them. And so that's very heartening.
Why do you think it strikes a chord?
I'm going by the experiences of friends and colleagues out there who are doing the teaching day to day. And I'm sure it's a topic that's of interest to you, Kendall, which is that they feel a weight's lifted off their shoulders. They don't have to solve everyone's problems. Mm. So it focuses on their well-being is the starting point.
Yeah.
And it kind of explains why I've had two cricketers in the last week whom I mentor, and the conversation's supposed to be about cricket, right? Completely separately and independently, they must have looked me up in Google and said, how can I learn motivational interview? And then when I go and chat to them on the side, I feel, what's that about? They say, oh, well, basically, they've been at the receiving end of enough brutal conversations themselves. You know? So much so that I think some of you know that I've in my grumpy old man state, I sometimes think we should create a field called homology. As being the, you know, there's helpology and harmology, if you like. There's a lot of harm being done, and I don't think it adequate attention is being paid to it, to be a little bit militant. But could I highlight something that I believe has come up in the chat here? And I believe it was our dear friend, and I'm trying to find the post, Merav Devere. Okay. She's done action research in organizational settings.
Where's Merav? Oh, there she is.
2006. And she's saying that this is an organizational, cultural, and political issue rather than a psychological one. And I think she's quite right. I really agree with you. And it struck me working as a psychologist in sport that what they really need are sociologists, not psychologists. So it kind of carries a certain call to humility there because, you know, MI is about conversation, but I sometimes wonder whether it's best presented as, look, this is about a social matter. MI is like a fuel that helps social exchanges feel healthier. Because it was a question about how would you do this in an organization? And then I kind of feel that it's not such a big deal. You know, this distinction between the Rogerian and the forward-looking momentum of MI, because I find you can say to people, look, sometimes the conversations are just about how people are feeling about stuff, in which case it can be helpful to listen to that. But sometimes the conversations are forward-looking, and where they're forward-looking, there's some serious evidence that you can develop skills that make a difference. I don't know, am I gabbling on?
No, you're not gabbling on at all, Steve. I'm just having that roam through my head and what that might look like and sound like. And at some point, it's like a conversation starts out with goodwill and good faith, and then evolves into more of a motivational interviewing conversation, depending on how it unfolds. So if I'm knowledgeable and skilled at motivational interviewing, that doesn't mean I need to do it. I just need to see if there's an opportunity to step towards it. If I'm thinking about it being an organization, if I'm a manager and I'm working with somebody. Lynn had another interesting question about the stages of change, the trans-theoretical model stages of change. And she wondered if we've thrown the baby out with the bathwater in the MI world, in terms of, I guess what you'd be saying is almost distancing ourselves from stages of change. I'm wondering if there was an oversimplification or refocus on the stage of change at the expense of the other aspects of the model, of the trans-theoretical model, particularly the two processes of change, particularly the processes of change. My understanding is that one is a theory about change, and you know the work that Prochaska, DiClemente, and Norcross did that was groundbreaking, and one is an MI is an intervention, and dare I say, intervention at this point in time is a way of talking with people about change that can be used with any model of change, or without having a model of change. Because there is no theory to motivational interviewing. And I don't think, because in the first two editions of the book, there were specific chapters around the stages of change. And in the third, it wasn't there. And maybe people are interpreting it that, you know, you and Bill in your writing, you're thinking of MI, have tried to distance yourself from being model-based. Stage change model based.
Yes, certainly to the extent that we're not looking for a theory of MI. I mean, that's just been a consistent thread running right through it. I remember when we sat down to write the first edition, we had this immediate congruence that we shouldn't be the ones to construct a theory. There was enough work to be done on the practical front. Let's do it and leave theory to other people. Because no sooner we construct a theory, then whole hosts of academic activity then gets sucked into it, when really, let's keep to the practical. So that's been consistent all the way through. So hence, in all of these editions, and particularly the latter ones, we haven't gone too much into why and the theory. And that's probably, you know, and if we did, how much attention would we give to the stages of change model? Probably quite a lot. We did give some attention to it in the fourth edition. I can't remember how much, but we're contented cousins is a phrase we came up with. We still feel that way. So Lynn, it's by no means the case that we kind of have got an attitude towards the stages of change model. But I think it's also a real good plan for us to kind of broaden our wings and say, what other models, concepts, ideas should we really be looking at, given we've got a broader definition? And psychological safety is one that I've been wondering about. So I've done a little bit of digging. It's too late for MI4, and I'm not sorry about that. But I've noticed in organizations, for example, that psychological safety is apparently really important. The question then becomes, how do you help people create it? And, you know, as Merav has said, this is a social and organizational matter that has psychological consequences. So I've been wondering about, you know, what are the social interventions, if you like, that MI can help with? And there are other concepts and ideas that we could and probably should be looking at. What is growth?
Is it subjective or objective? You know, who's defining what growth is for one person to another, from another? And how does that fit with autonomy, supporting autonomy?
And Hannah's saying that psychological safety is where she finds MI links with trauma-informed work. And for those of you that may have been in Chicago, know that Merav and I are interested in the MI and trauma-informed intersection. And that's where we do our kind of work around psychological safety. And so, Steve, that sense of what, when somebody is psychologically unsafe as a clinician, if we're just looking at it from that lens, what does that mean? And how interesting, from our lens, what can we do to support that? And what can cultures do? And when we then take it even wider, as Merav's talking about, into the socio-political world that we exist within, how psychologically safe do many of us feel, especially in climates, I don't know about in other countries, but in the UK, where we have contracts that are that are pay by results. So where clinicians don't get their contracts renewed if they're not getting results. And that can feel that it's at odds with motivational interviewing, because it's losing, in one way, control. That's how they feel. And so that sense of what psychological safety means within an organizational perspective is so important. And how do we create that? Contented cousins. Oh, yeah, that's the TTM, isn't it? Sorry, I'm just looking at other things that people have written as well. So the evolutionary theory, definitely around status.
I think it's time to open this up and consider any questions people might have. I hope we've done a reason. I hope I've done a half reasonable job. I think I hit the essence of the changes. There's probably some smaller, minor ones.
So Sandy Francis asked a question, Joel, if I can put that in. I don't know if Sandy's still there.
Please do.
That said, there was a mention a while ago about congruence being discussed with a view for being included in this new book, and did it get in? And if so, why? If not, why not?
Gonna have to ask Bill that. I know he felt very strongly about genuineness as being a piece that wasn't dealt with. And we had a long discussion about where genuineness comes in, and it comes in somewhere, not necessarily in the spirit. But he's gone into that in quite a lot of detail. He wrote those pieces. And I don't know about congruence. I don't think so.
Well, you're stepping really towards person-centered therapy when we start bringing in congruence, genuineness, authenticity, which I'm all for. So, but I mean, that's a different move. It's a different pivot in terms of motivational interviewing, because not only are you talking about client congruence, you're talking about counselor congruence or facilitator congruence and the importance of that. I've been in an interesting conversation with Terry Moyers about how would you teach genuineness, because they identified it in a skill in their effective psychotherapist books, Miller and Moyers. And so we've been going back and forth of how do you teach somebody to be genuine? If it's a skill, right? You know, but that's a whole nother conversation.
I want to know what you came up with. So maybe we should get Terry on here and we should have a conversation about that as well.
Yeah, I'll talk with her about that.
There was another question as well. Arlene is asking, did you leave the firm as a part of acceptance and a core skill?
Could you repeat that?
Yeah. Let me just get it up again. Sorry. Just lost it. Did you leave a firm and affirmations as part of acceptance and a core skill?
Yes. No, we got the same oars. Yeah. We got the same oars. There's a problem there, which we discussed. And again, I went along with Bill, which is an affirmation is usually a statement. So you could argue that an affirmation is a form of reflection. Okay. In which case, let's make it simpler. But he so loves acronyms and he so loves oars, he wouldn't let it go. So off we went.
So as a trainer, that's something that we often get, especially in people that are quite new to MI. Yeah. You know, is an affirmation just a reflection? And it's quite hard as a trainer to decide and talk that through. So Molly, you know, from your side with your research, I wonder how you bring that in as well. Because Charlotte is saying, I wonder if reflective listening is also very affirming. And I know when we're coding, and Fiona and I have been doing some coding, it can be really hard to distinguish between just a really beautiful, complex reflection and an affirmation.
I mean, I'm happy with keeping the distinction between the two and allowing them to overlap. And I'm actually, that's coming from someone who is really wants things to be orthogonal when it comes to measurement, but they can be a reflection. They're not necessarily a reflection. And I think more about the function. So thinking about reflections that function as listening, as evoking, as evolving a conversation versus affirmations that function as reinforcing, as empowering, as strengths building. And so making that distinction seems important to me. I think it was Chris Wagner who put in the chat questions or maybe statements around that the MI4 book is doing the simple versus complex affirmations and also speaking to directional versus non-directional reflections. So is that happening in the book or is that not happening in the book? I guess the question is, are some of the ors being almost discriminated or defined further for teaching purposes?
I think we've strengthened that distinction, yeah. Yeah. And yeah. I see you in my writing and training very, very clearly. It's well worthwhile.
I agree.
There's a crazy question here.
It's actually, let's have it.
It's a bumper one.
Okay. Well, I'm just aware we still have 200 people here and we're at 7:30 and I'm more than happy to keep going. If people are hanging in here and I'm enjoying this discussion and learning from the questions and the comments and all of y'all. So, you know, this is good professional development for me.
Me too.
But we're on the half hour, so we could effectively say the webinar's over, but we're going to carry on chatting. Is that correct?
That's correct. So officially the webinar is over. So now let's have some fun. Thanks for your questions, Lynn, and your comments.
Yeah. Amazing. Thank you, everybody. If you do need to go, for coming along and participating. And before we close the things, thanks to Steve as well for helping us and sharing everything that you've done with us, because it's just incredible. And I'm really excited to get the new book. Have to take a few weeks off to redo everything I do. Thanks, Steve.
I think one of the things that I'm sitting with me with this discussion is that, you know, technically or structurally things haven't changed that much, other than empowerment, you know, moving into the spirit. And as Bill put it when I asked him about the third edition, you know, what happened to reds, you know, and what happened to developing discrepancy and all of these things. And he just said they didn't go away. They just kind of fell naturally where they should have been all along. And that's kind of the sense I'm getting with some of the thinking around MI3. It's not like because we don't have evoking, therefore MI is not evoking. It's just woven into everything about motivational interviewing. And it seems like that's kind of what I get the feel of as I listen to this conversation, is that it's not, the thinking is shifting and how we think about people, change, growth, and working with them is what's shifting, not so much the technical side of Rick. Motivational.
No, that's correct, Joel. I'll tell you something else that that was a very hot issue for me and for Bill and I. And I think it is reflected to some extent in the book, but not nearly enough as far as I was concerned, which is that the major development for me in my practice of MI was inside me, not in my skills with people. And if you like, it's a bit of a crude way of putting it, the mindset and heart set of the helper hasn't been emphasized adequately. And if I think about the three editions, the first two or three, and maybe to some extent, it's all about them and how we are with them. But how we are with ourselves has been neglected. So, and I think Bill accepted this, but he finds it difficult because he is so naturally mindful and heartful himself when he speaks to people, that it wasn't a big struggle for him, whereas it was for me, because I am naturally an enthusiastic writing reflexer. I like to sort problems out, as he said. It was a much more powerful personal journey for me. And also, he is a naturally calm person. He's quite calm, whereas I'm more volatile. And I think most people are probably somewhere in between, or more like me than him. He's quite unusual. And so the emotional regulation and well-being of the helper, you could argue, is 50% of the story.
Certainly, if you're thinking about it from collaboration perspective.
Yeah.
But if true collaboration is that both of you are showing up, then absolutely. one of the things that really strikes me with what you're saying, Steve, is Gabor Maté. He talks a lot. I don't know if anyone knows Gabor Maté, but, you know, he does a lot about the trauma work. But what he talks about is that a lot of clinicians are in trauma and have unresolved trauma, or that they're in active trauma. And on top of that, he talks about a lot of organizations and institutions. Now, let's, for me, I work in the UK. You've got the NHS, where you have people in perpetual trauma by the institution itself. And so, of course, the clinicians aren't, they're not able to be as zen as Bill is when we see him. Right. He kind of glides. Whereas, and it's, so our work often as trainers is to psychologically regulate and create safety for the clinicians so that they can go to their work and their patients and show up and feel like just a little bit more at peace and less traumatized. I don't know if that resonates with anybody else in the space, but often our work as trainers is doing an intervention. Our training is an intervention in itself. It's very inception-like.
Be for some people, for sure. I think I've talked to other people, and they said, you know, learning MI was transformative, including, you know, Bill Miller. I mean, the years ago he did this presentation, "Am I Still a Behaviorist?" You know, or something like that, and you know, the shift within him. I can't speak for Bill, so I won't. But I was thinking about something, Steve, as you were talking, and it seems that at least, you know, in the training of psychologists, part of the training in the 60s, 70s, and 80s was kind of doing your own work, you know, and being willing to kind of get on the couch if you're going to ask people to be on the couch. And that drifted away. And I'm not completely sure why. and so I think part of it is in people's development. Now, we're talking about people who do, I'm talking about counseling and psychotherapy, you know, this gets back to congruence. It's self-exploration is a part of it, and encouraging that in people. And, you know, I don't know that's too broad of a brush for motivational interviewing in that way, but I do know that when people learn how to do reflective listening and are genuine, that it does kind of shift the way that they do their practice. I've seen some pretty hardened addiction counselors, you know, come about face when they actually saw, if I can let go of this and experiment with that, it feels better to both the client and myself, because that's what I wanted to do anyway. But I was trained that I had to be a hard ass to get it to happen.
That's superb. I see David Koss is asking a question here. To follow up on Kendall's funny comment, one takeaway from today is that we do not need to redo everything we do. I think you're talking sort of as a trainer, or maybe as a practitioner. However, what words or comments or evocations that we do now does the fourth edition recommend that we should no longer do? Well, if you remember my opening comment, the fourth edition is just a framework. So what you do is going to be your choice, your unique way of integrating this way of being and having a conversation that makes sense to you. So, you know, just start there. Okay, David. And what comments with clients does the fourth edition recommend we now make? I would say absolutely no difference. You know, you want to be your authentic self talking about change in such a way that this person feels safe and brave enough to envision new ways of handling things. That's it. You know, that it's as simple as that. One item I've heard from outside this meeting is to emphasize reflections and affirmations to an even greater extent that is now covered in training. I'm not sure there's a lot of uniformity in training. I think there's probably a hell of a lot of diversity. Emphasizing reflections and affirmations, you know, there is a bit of a puzzle here, which is if somebody is facing forward with another person they're helping, okay, so it's not client-centered counseling. I'm wondering what Molly makes of this, right? They're facing forward in a conversation about change. Let's say it's about behavior change. Okay, so we're in home ground here, Molly. And they're very good at asking these open questions about change. Why is it that you'd like to make this change? How do you see this working? And the person's envisioning. Is it essential to use reflective listening? Does that impact outcome more than if they just used open questions? And for me, this is like a hell of an important question if I'm doing training, because as David is saying, should we be emphasizing the use of reflection more? I've noticed over the years, I used to show off with our special treat, which is reflective listening. And it was almost like a special discovery or jewel that we've discovered. And I noticed my ego being a little bit over-involved in that, actually. And now I'm wondering, if you've got a gentle, kind soul who's exhibiting the spirit of MI and using mostly open questions, what's the problem?
I think the hearing back is crucial. And I still see MI as a psycholinguistic exchange that creates a narrative. And so while the client hearing themselves is very important, the client hearing the therapist interpret, you know, or reflect back what the therapist heard is also important. And together, those things weave a storyline very much in the sense of like a narrative therapy or something like that, that, you know, that is part, in my mind, that is very much part of the process, that hearing back.
That's beautifully put. And so maybe reflection is important, but certainly not any more or less important in the fourth edition to the third. Just to return to David's question. Thanks, Molly. That was super, super clear.
Well, and that's, but I'll also just to resonate so much with what you said earlier about, you know, how MI helped you. And so there is just the very simple piece of how reflections help to kind of keep us self-regulated.
Exactly.
It forces you to listen.
Exactly.
You know, if you're formulating questions. I mean, of course, you have to listen to come up with a good question that carries forward the last thing that was said, but still, it's not quite the same listening as what it takes to do reflections.
I tend to agree with you. It's like you lose the music. You lose the lovely melody. But okay. I noticed I came up with these things called my six C's. This must have been about 5 years ago. I often forgot them and never put them in any book. I don't know whether they're in MA4. I think Bill did put them in somewhere, which is that my reminders to myself, me, just as a single human being, are to let go of three C's. Okay, cleverness, complexity, and clutter. That's what I remind myself. And then to hold on to compassion, curiosity, and I've forgotten the last C. There you go. I always forget one. So I got five right. But, you know, it was a formulation that I found extremely helpful, because I found that I could bear that in mind and settle myself down in an emotionally regulated and calm way with someone. It's hard for a lot of people.
Cleverness, clutter, and the complexity was the other one?
Clutter,
for the ones you're letting go of?
Clutter, yeah. Cleverness, and complexity. And Tanya's got the other one, yeah. And hold on to curious, calm, and compassionate. Thanks, Tanya. I've completely forgotten.
Yeah, no.
I have to let go of control. I'm adding my C of control to let go of.
Yeah, and then there's loads of other C's, but, you know, thank you. Yeah, I'm just getting a hang of it, Chris Wagner. Yeah, sort of. I lose my every now and then, you know.
Can I just add to what Molly's talking about the control thing and just with what Steve's saying as well? And I'm going to bring in my trauma lens a little bit here. that I've done a lot of work about whether the writing reflex is a trauma response and whether our need for control is part of our fawning or our fight, flight, our threat system. And a lot of the times when the clinicians, we notice that they're jumping into the writing reflex, there's usually a sense of rescuing coming from an internal desire to fix and to keep everything safe, as we all know is, you know, in that way. But it's something that we often notice as what Steve's saying is, you know, having a mantra about the three C's or the six C's. And Molly, you're saying about the letting go of control. And it's so difficult to do that when it's ingrained in us, and especially when we're in more of a heightened state around our practice or around our need with our clients. And how do we anchor ourselves? And I'm curious about the MI4 definition feels a lot more in line with this idea for us being in a growth mindset as well as our clients.
Yeah, not enough as far as I was concerned, but it's there.
Yeah. And I'd love to know where you want to go, Steve, because you've said this a few times. Like, where would if you'd have gone further, where would you have gone?
Good question.
I would have peppered the book with observations about how the clinician was feeling at the time that they said whatever they said in the dialogue, and used that dialogue and those comments about how the people are feeling, particularly the helper, to highlight constructive and less constructive conversation. I would have done it inductively like that. Both said I was needlessly complicating it, which is could also be true. I think this idea about control is very interesting, because you're controlling, if you like, the kind of overall direction of the conversation. So it's not completely letting go control. You're steering the overall direction of the conversation, but not the content. Well, you are to some extent, but the desire to control everything is like almost like an emotional experience that is well worth letting go. I agree with that. Mm. And it's very hard. The more expert in training people have, the harder it is for them.
And that speaks to the other potential piece of it. There's the, you know, the trauma piece can be one aspect of it, but then, as you mentioned, you know, there's also the ego piece and the idea of, you know, helping people and having answers feels good. So we're just, you know, as therapists, kind of pressing the lever of like, oh, there's my dopamine spike of, you know, being able to have the right answer or the magical insight or the opportunity to use this really cool thing I learned 2 days ago in my, you know, in my class or whatever. And that's, you know, those are also really important pieces of control that I think MI helps regulate us away from.
Yeah, and we're looking pretty much at the shadow side of all of this, aren't we? Because there is a place for in helpfulness for solving a problem for people that I don't think necessarily has a dark or shadowy origin. And in fact, in the Yiddish language, there's a term called what's it, mensch, M-E-N-S-C-H. It comes from Yiddish, right? And a mensch is that person who's got this kind of combination of good sense, compassion, and practical solutions to a problem. So a mensch steps in and solves a problem with compassion and good practical common sense, and it's widely appreciated and respected. So it's I think it's got more to do with how you do this. It does often come from a good place, and I feel that the ask, offer, ask framework is a super, super channel for channeling the writing reflex. Because you ask someone's permission, would you mind? And then, you know, and then you're immediately regulated yourself and you're listening. So a little bit worried that there's a too much shadow talk about the writing reflex. Not that it's invalid, but that there is a positive side to this that can be channeled. How's that?
Well, I agree. And I think it's a signal to me that if I'm feeling the urge to jump in or correct somebody, and I think y'all are going to, are y'all going to rename it the helping reflex?
Fixing reflex, he wanted. I went, so, okay, sure, I don't care.
Okay, fixing reflex. So it comes from a help, a desire to be helpful.
Yeah.
But it's that moment of going, I really want to correct, or I really want to jump in, or I feel like I need to defend myself because the person said, how could you possibly know anything about me? And I can go, okay, there's that's there. Now let me use that as a way to guide what I say next and what would be helpful.
Exactly. In that situation. And you want to be your authentic self. Yesterday, I was sitting with a guy who I've seen probably 10, 15 times. You know, he's a high-end elite athlete. We were sitting on a bench in the sun and he looked at me and he says, you never tell me, what do you think? Bang, right? So I said, you really want to know? He said, yeah. So I said, I told him. I didn't go eat. Ask offer ask. I just said, you're asking me. Here's what I think. Yeah. Oh, okay. You know, but that's in the context of feeling and being authentic.
Yeah.
Okay.
And having an established relationship.
And exactly. And this is something that I think we don't deal with adequately. I think if you've got a good enough relationship with someone, you can just order them what to do. Michael Gervais, the well-known American sports psychologist, I went on his podcast and he pointed, and he's with the Seattle Seahawks and this, you know, he's like a real high-end psychologist. And he says, he was on some kind of paddleboard marathon and he fell flat on his face and he absolutely couldn't get up. He just couldn't get up. And he was just about to cross the finishing line when his coach, who was in a boat nearby, just shouted at him and said, stand up. And he said it was phenomenal, the impact of it. He stood up and finished. So he presented this as, and I think to kind of be serious for a moment, if you do have a good enough relationship with somebody, a lot of the traps we are fearful about when you're just developing a relationship, they're not too much of a problem. So, and I don't think we've dealt with that adequately.
No, I agree. I mean, I'm very different in my interaction with somebody I've been working with for 3 months versus this is our second session.
Yeah.
Chris Wagner says, well, if you've got such a good relationship with your son, just tell him to clean his room. I think it's time to wind down.
We can call that's fine. We're almost at 2 hours into this.
Stop myself asking you to get Chris to come on and explain what he's saying, but I'm not going to.
I already invited Chris to come on, and he said he'd rather listen. And
no, it's too weird.
All right. Well, look. So everybody in the audience, thank you so much for coming along. 100 plus people hung out for 2 hours with us. We really appreciate it. All your interactions and questions and thoughts and knowing Steve is that he's taking it on board as well as the rest of us. Molly, thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us. It's always a pleasure to listen to you and get your take on motivational interviewing. You really have a brilliant way of looking at it and articulating what you know. So it's very helpful to me. Thank you. And as always, Kendall and Steve, it's a pleasure sharing virtual space with you. I look forward to seeing the three of you later this year in Copenhagen. And we can sit down and have a proper conversation.
Yeah.
Any closing thoughts from anybody before we say goodbye?
Nice way to spend the afternoon.
Great. Okay, Molly.
Molly, thank you very much, Shane.
Thank you to everyone and to Molly and Steve and Joel, as always, for this as well. And it's a lovely way to spend. Well, for me, it's my evening, and the same with Steve as well. And it's just lovely and given me a lot of food for thought. So,
all right. Well, and with that, we will call it a webinar.
Well,
bye, everyone.
Bye, Molly. Be well.
Yeah, boy.